Quickly, before this episode begins, I want to say a heartfelt thank you and acknowledgement to the band The Beths and the artist Van Nystad, both of whose work features heavily in this episode. Thank you for the inspiration and the gorgeous golden contribution you have made to my creativity, not only in this episode, but all of my work ever. I have laid paths to both The Beths and to Van's work in the description of this episode, so hopefully you can go and enjoy their work as much as I do. I hate Christmas music. Christmas music, to me, is the embodiment of all the parts of Christmas that I hate. Christmas music is grown in a lab music. It's public service announcement music, love without commitment music, sold as sentiment music, artificial sweetener music. But there are a handful of exceptions that seem to prove the rule, and one of them is a cover of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas by the New Zealand band The Beths.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
This is a song that sounds like the soul of Christmas. A song that sounds like homemade Christmas baking. A song that feels like early morning stillness and welling eyes and absent family. This is a song that sounds like the soulful, intimate, careful deliberation of gift giving. And I think that's why I hate generic Christmas music with the raging passion that I do, because it reminds me of the complete opposite of this intimate feeling. Generic Christmas music reminds me of the soul-muting squeals of consumerism's obligated gift-giving and family connection reluctantly. Gifting is for the soul, and the soul is for gifting, regardless of if it's for Christmas, for birthdays, or a spontaneous Thursday. And the best cover of this famous Christmas song captures that soul with its quiet, slow rhythm and warm, thoughtful tones, like the deliberate act of gift-giving. And it eventually erupts into a euphoric instrumental, which reminds me of that impossible to articulate feeling of knowing that you are loved by someone and that they know you love them back. This is my love letter to gifting. Trench warfare must surely be one of the most hellish, miserable environments that humans have endured. Trench warfare was so brutal in World War I due to improvements in military firepower not being accompanied by an equal increase in mobility, resulting in a grueling stalemate where the advantage was always held by the defending side. Attempts at attack, even if successful, usually sustained severe casualties. Thus, each day ended in a state indistinguishable from its beginning, as if the fronts were locked in a time vacuum on pause for eternity. Each front was tethered by the veins of supply lines feeding rations, ammunition, and reinforcement into the back of the trenches. Therefore, a possible way to end the stalemate was to bomb your opposition's supply line into a state that more closely resembled the moon instead of the veins of an army. But the air remained silent, and the supply lines remained healthy. The trouble was, if you bombed the enemy supply lines, they would just bomb your supply lines right back. So, both front supply lines remained healthy under zero written or verbal agreement at all, just spontaneous mutual cooperation. This sudden, random, unagreed-upon cooperation in warfare is often called live and let live. Other examples are agreed-upon cooperation to not shoot men while they rested or when they ventured into no man's land to rescue or recover their comrades. Mutual, spontaneous restraint is an unexpected behavior to emerge on the battlefield, of all places. And what made it possible and worth doing was the static, grueling nature of trench warfare, where the same groups of soldiers were stuck in a deadlock for an extended period of time. They know that the other side will remember what they do. So if one group wants the other to behave in a certain way without actually agreeing upon it verbally, they themselves will have to behave in that way and hope the others do the same. This is essentially a massive scale version of treat others the way you want to be treated. The opposition will hopefully notice this behavior, and since it benefits them and they would like it to continue, they will reciprocate the behavior. The fronts even disobeyed their commanders to act cooperatively. Perhaps it's withholding fire at medics or resting soldiers or not bombing supply lines. Whatever the behavior, the best way to cooperate is through reciprocity. This strategy of mimicking your opponent's behavior is known as tit for tat. Tit for tat is a fantastic strategy for creating collaboration between competing individuals or groups, as both parties know they are likely to receive back what they give forward. Because of this ability to turn competitors into collaborators, tit for tat behavior is seen in various corners of the natural world. Birds give out warning calls and protect each other's nests, bats donate food to starving peers, and chimps groom each other's backs. In each instance, an individual carries out a self-adverse act in the hope their peers will do the same for them when they need it most. Thus, it has been theorized that many, many thousands of years ago, tit-for-tat played out among primitive Homo sapiens, nurturing the collaborative, loving, gift-giving souls we are now. Homo sapiens likely evolved in the scattered trees and shrubs of eastern Africa savannas. It's been theorized that within this environment they evolved into a niche called the cognitive niche. The cognitive niche states that within any ecosystem on the planet, the possibility exists for any organism to overtake other organisms through reasoning and cooperative action rather than particular features of their biology. Compare this to almost any other organism on Earth which evolves fixed features for their survival, like protective shells or extreme mobility, night vision or natural camouflage. Instead, the niche the humans evolved into, the cognitive niche, prioritized intelligent planning and cooperation to overcome these natural pressures instead of evolving fixed specific features. They made tools, traps, and weapons instead of sharp teeth and talons. They extracted poisons and drugs from other animals and plants instead of evolving an immunity to it themselves. And they laid plans for coordinating, hunting, and traveling instead of evolving migration mentality in large groups. The cognitive niche is like a Swiss Army knife. It allows humans to invent ways to overcome nature rather than evolving them over time. The techniques and tools that humans develop are fluid, arising spontaneously in response to new challenges and being refined over time with increasing intricacy. Because humans could develop and refine their arsenal of tools and techniques in real time rather than waiting millions of years for evolution to do it, they had a tremendous advantage over other organisms. Even before the current anthropogenic mass extinction we're seeing now, prehistoric humans were so good at outcompeting other organisms that they caused significant extinctions whenever they first entered a new environment. Evolution is simply too slow to adapt to the extreme versatility of the human's cognitive niche. The spine of the cognitive niche is cooperation, because no single human has the capacities, physical nor mental, to invent, develop, and gather the resources required to best nature's wrath and hunt the competition. No human is born with the genius to invent all the tools that past generations have, and so you have to rely on other humans to give you both the ideas and the resources to catch up with the new technology. Thus, humans cooperate. They trade goods, favors, and knowledge, and they act together to raise buildings, hunts, and children. The same brain that the cognitive niche needed for tool-making and planning is equally great at navigating a social community and cooperating. Humans carry out a plethora of emotions to engage in anger, guilt, trust, disappointment, and love. Acts of kindness or cooperation sow gratefulness and trust within you. Acts of deceit or difficulty sow rage and resent. As you've probably gathered, this is the world of tit for tat. In this great wide world where cooperation is key, humans must find a way to become part of a strong collaborative community. Otherwise, the wide world gets even wider and harsher. Here comes Tit for Tat, in a game which revolves around reputation. To gain the trust and companionship needed for these communities, ancient humans had to act for others that did not benefit themselves, like donating food or knowledge. By doing this, the other humans would be more likely to do these acts in return, like inviting participation in hunts or sharing new knowledge. It's the other side of the coin, though, that is more important. Acts of deceit or deceptiveness significantly lower the amount of trust and respect that other humans will have for this new villain, meaning they are far less likely to include the villain in collaborative events, leaving this new villain out on their own. Tit-for-tat behavior in early humans encouraged collaboration and building reputation, because the alternative meant isolation, and isolation meant a step closer to the grave. But this is cold. It's doing something for someone in the hope they do something for you in return. It's damn practical, but it's rather icy, I think. And this icy practicality occasionally melts into a warm, loving relationship where there is nothing needed in return, where acts of kindness are done purely out of care for the other soul. This is love, whether it's for your mum and your dad, or your brother, or your partner. And here, I think, is where gifting comes from. True gifting, not tit-for-tat gifting, not obligated generic Christmas gifting, but true, deliberate, loving, careful gift-giving. It's early December as I write this. I'm about to experience my 20th Christmas. For the first 15, maybe 16 of those Christmases, I cared very little about the gifts under the tree other than those with MAX written on the tag. I still care very, very deeply about the gifts with my name on them, but since the 17th Christmas or so, I have cared about them for a much different reason. I care about them because my name is in the from section of the tag, not the for section. These are gifts that I have bought for my loved ones, and the joy I feel when they receive them is describable only by that euphoric instrumental from the Beth's Christmas cover. Gifting is easy. The generic gifting, that is, the gifting you feel forced to do, the tit-for-tat gifting. But true gifting, out of nothing but love, where your goal is to make the other person feel that radiating love you have for them, is extremely hard. And here I want to share a little guide to gift giving, originally written by one of my favorite practical and video artists, the spirited man Van Nystad. I present to you Van Nystadt's Holy Trinity of Gift Giving, with a few additions by me. Imagine a triangle. On each side is a different element that connects with our soul. A good gift shall contain any two of the three elements, while the best gifts, the truly divine gifts, have all three elements, completing the triangle. The three elements are thoughtfulness, niceness, and craftiness. Thoughtfulness, a nebulous concept. Receivers of gifts really love what's called relationship-orientated thoughtfulness, that is, gifts that contain thoughtfulness purely out of love for them. What that really means is that receivers want a gift that has been thought about with only them in mind, like gifts that commemorate a special occasion that you share with them or that represent something symbolic between you. Here, there is no room for tit-for-tat gifts, for gifts running off stereotypes or obligation, trends or monetary value, because these don't show care about the person receiving the gift. It shows an appeal to what is socially considered a quote-unquote good gift. Thoughtfulness is arguably the hardest of these three elements because you need to know the person relatively well to know what would speak to their soul and make them feel loved. But everyone will have something, you just have to figure out what that is. Niceness. We all know what a nice gift is, but often that goes against that element of thoughtfulness, as people gift hollow, generic jewellery or nice chocolates. But critical to niceness is understanding that it is not the same as expensive. Super expensive gifts can often be burdens of guilt and self-doubt, as receivers question that their love is worth the high price tag that undoubtedly attached to the gift. This reintroduces tit-for-tat themes, as an expensive gift usually comes burdened with the idea of repayment. To demonstrate how nice is different from expensive, think about a gift of socks, let's say. Socks wrapped in wrapping paper sound dreadfully boring and the complete opposite of a quote-unquote nice gift. And they are, if the socks are your standard, boring, only thinking about them when you do laundry sort of socks. But if the socks were nice socks, like special merino socks or Japanese handcrafted hemp socks, then all of a sudden the socks are transformed into an interesting, nice gift that the person can look forward to putting on, like a holiday for your feet. But crucially, not expensive. Expensive for socks, perhaps, but they are really nice, not expensive in general. Finally, there is craftiness. Craftiness is the art of putting your own handiwork into the gift somehow. This infuses the gift with an incredible amount of extra power because it signifies time devoted to the gift, out of nothing except a longing to deliver the recipient something they will like and ensuring that it effectively communicates that love radiating from your soul. Now, the possibilities here vary massively. If your bones are made of clay and your veins of paint, then creating a gift from thin air with the power of your artistic ability would be a gorgeous gift for someone you'd love. But if your body contains not a fragment of such creativity, then simply engraving the person's name or a date of significance would also count as craftiness. If you were gifting perhaps a watch or a piece of jewelry, then engraving the person's initials or a date significant to you both would add that extra handmade power. You don't even have to do it yourself, as a professional engraving service would still infuse that same effect of time thought and care taken. Now, with the three separate sides of the triangle established, we have to start combining them. As I mentioned, a good gift contains any two of these elements, but the greatest, most legendary, contain all three. A nice, thoughtful gift could be a gorgeous little set of ceramic cups for a friend who just moved into a new place with no kitchenware. This little gift ticks off being nice and thoughtful, as it's high quality, but it also is a thoughtful thing to give to somebody given their current life situation. But to turn this pure little gift into one of divine quality, the third element could be added through some handmade part. Perhaps the cups were hand-painted by you or engraved with the receiver's new address on the bottom. One of my favorite gifts I have ever received was during last year's Christmas, and it was from my girlfriend. It's a little wooden box with a painted bird of paradise flower on the lid. This is a gorgeous, high-quality box, which makes it nice. It's also thoughtful because it has a flower on it that my girlfriend and I share a fascination with, and just that summer we had seen many of the orange and blue flowers on our adventures together. Finally, it has nothing but the highest level of handmade quality, for she had painted the bird of paradise onto it with some other little details and glazed the box afterwards, further adding to that niceness. This gift fulfills the holy trinity of gifting perfectly. I feel so dearly loved each time I handle the box in my hands or brush it in my vision. The holy trinity is divine in power, but it is not sacred. The point is not to follow the three elements, thoughtfulness, niceness, and craftiness, religiously. Rather, the point is to deliberate and think with your heart about what would make the person you are gifting to feel loved and thought of. I really, really love what Van Nistat originally said about giving a divine gift.
And I get choked up thinking about it. And the object, your goal in giving a present and giving a gift is to make the receiver cry. That is your goal.
I hate Christmas music. I hate Christmas music because it's a call to the icy, soulless obligation of seasonal gift giving. The tit for tat gift giving. And I love gift giving, but I hate the idea of doing it because I'm expected to, and I hate the idea that the person receiving the gift feels obligated to give me one back, and perhaps immediately thinks about what they gave me and not about the love I'm trying to express to them. But to write off all of Christmas and all of the wrapped gifts under the tree because of just a few bruises would be irrational. Just as there are a small handful of good Christmas songs I love dearly, there are a small handful of things about Christmas I love greatly. I love coming together with my family and the people that I love. And I also love the hurtful feeling of knowing that not everyone is present who I wish was. And of course, I love gift giving. By now, you know exactly what I mean by that.